be something to delay it again. You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. After 16 years of providing literary programming, Kingston Writers Fest has announced that they will be ceasing operations. The news was shared in a release from the board of directors last week, citing ongoing financial challenges as the reason for the festival folding. The board states that declining attendance, increased operational costs, and reduced revenue since the pandemic have created deficits that cannot be overcome, with reserves being depleted years ago to sustain the festival. While costs were cut in 2024 with a scaled-down event and more intimate setting at the screening room, the changes were not enough to save the festival. Ara McCulley, who has worked for the festival for the past 11 years and has been artistic director since 2020, was told at the end of November that the festival's run would be coming to an end and that staff and contractors would be laid off. McCulley sat down with CFRC to discuss some of the reasons behind the decision to end the festival. To start us off, I was wondering if you could just get into some of the background here and some of the factors that led to this decision that we all learned last week.
I mean, it's been certainly a challenging environment for arts organizations in general since COVID first hit. You know, there's been a lot of articles, a lot of conversation, there's been other festivals that have folded as well. And I mean, it's a combination of different issues that have sort of brought us here. Part of it is the age of the core demographic for lots of arts organizations, which tends to be a little older. And those are the individuals that are more susceptible to illness from things like COVID and the flu. And as a festival that takes place at the end of September, which is sort of the start of that season, I think it's led to hesitancy from people to go out that would have gone out before, because they don't want to get sick. I think, too, people just got used to not going to events during COVID. And I think the kinds of things that people want to go to now that it's back are perhaps a lighter, like things like movie and music that is kind of easier to consume and doesn't take, you know, sometimes the emotional and mental bandwidth that, you know, reading a book for 20 hours might take. And, you know, we've seen cuts at all levels. A lot of government organizations sort of helped organizations during COVID, but as soon as that help stopped, most of them went to less than what they were giving organizations in 2019. So it's sort of, you know, we're still trying to regain audiences. Our audience was about 30% below what it was pre-COVID. And so when you combine that with having your funding cut by 5 to 10% at all levels, and then losing some corporate sponsors and seeing that drop in ticket sales, it's just it's a lot of issues to try and navigate at the same time as you're trying to put on a festival. And I think part of it too is just trying to figure out what people want. You know, we have one festival per year, and so experimenting can happen a little bit in the off season, but we don't know from year to year what the outcome is going to be. So, you know, our first year in person back, we were like, okay, well, we'll just plan as if we'll see a little bit less in attendance, but we'll just do the festival as we always have. And it took a couple of cycles to realize like that formula wasn't going to work anymore. So, you know, we did make some major changes here in 2024. But, you know, it takes a lot of time. And there is obviously a risk in keeping going when it could lead to you going further into debt. And that wasn't something that the board was comfortable doing for continuing on into 2025.
While the festival has been stretching to make ends meet for a number of years, McCulley spoke to the abruptness and finality of this announcement. While the statement from the board of directors stated the financial challenges make running the festival, quote, impossible, McCulley also expressed disappointment that more efforts were not made to save the festival. When you got the news at the end of November, I was wondering, was this kind of a big surprise for you, or were you kind of anticipating it with the struggles that you've been facing in the last few years?
The abruptness of it came as a bit of a surprise. I mean, I don't think it was a surprise to any of, like, there's one other staff member, but we have some contractors as well. I think, you know, we try to be really transparent with everyone we work with, so we all kind of knew the situation that we were in. I think the finality of it was a surprise. You know, Kingston has been incredibly supportive to the festival for the 16 years that it's been running. And to not give supporters one last chance to, you know, like if we had run a GoFundMe or something like that, one last chance to kind of just get us over this hurdle and into 2025 was disappointing for us. My colleague Jennifer and I had been doing a lot of work in developing a business plan to make the festival more sustainable. But, you know, again, these things take time. And so, yeah, I mean, it was sudden, but I mean, we all were realistic about the issues that the festival was facing.
In a social media post, McCulley shared that the wind down of the festival has not been smooth, with the abrupt ending, her and other staff not receiving severance pay, and missing paychecks for staff and contractors. Here's what McCulley had to say on these issues. The wind down has not been a smooth process from what I've gathered, including you not receiving your severance that you're owed and a lack of communication with staff members. I was wondering if you could speak to that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, not only severance, I mean, we were not given any notice when we were let go. So staff was not paid for the month of November. So we're owed that salary. Also, my colleague hadn't cashed her October check, so she's actually owed 2 months of salary. And then as someone who's been working with the festival for 11 years, I should have received severance pay. And that has not materialized either. And so it made for a really difficult December, certainly trying to navigate that with no income coming in. So, you know, and we're not the only ones that weren't getting paid. And that was one of the reasons that I made a post on my own Facebook about it, was just as the face of the organization, as the person that people know, I'm the person that's getting asked. And if I'm being quiet about bills that aren't getting paid, the assumption is that I'm ignoring people or that I'm willfully withholding money. And I just wanted to let people know that, like, staff and contractors are in the exact same boat as everybody else in this situation, unfortunately.
McCulley has contacted the province regarding the lack of severance pay. The Writers' Fest Board of Directors did not respond to requests for comment from CFRC. McCulley had the following parting words for Writers' Fest attendees and message for Kingstonians in the literary community. I was wondering, just reflecting on the past 11 years that you've been with the festival, if you had any parting words for those who've enjoyed the festival over many years and what perhaps the Kingston literary community can look forward to still.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that was the saddest for me was with the suddenness of the decision and the request that we not be public about the fact that we're closing is that I didn't get an opportunity to say anything to the public. You know, it's I've been going to the festival since 2010, so I've been there, you know, attending for 15 years, working there for 11. Obviously, it's an organization that's really near and dear to my heart. I've made some incredible connections within the community, with other arts partners, with local authors, with artists, and just the amazing audiences that have come year after year. And so, you know, I really just wanted to say what a pleasure and a privilege it's been to be part of this journey. You know, Kingston is very special. It's got a really vibrant arts community. Authors loved coming to this festival because of the audiences that came out and their thoughtful questions and their engagement. That's something I think that's really special and that we should be really proud of. And, you know, speaking to some of my colleagues, some of the contractors and staff that have worked with the festival, nobody wants this to be goodbye. So I think there are hopes that, you know, we can do at least one-off author events here in Kingston. This is leaving a huge vacuum for a really important, like, there is no other literary festival that happens here. And so for authors, that's a huge vacuum that, you know, as amazing as something like Novel Ideas, they can only program so many book launches in a year, right? And so to be able to offer a platform in some way, I think, is something that we really hope to do, and to continue to celebrate the amazing authors that are here in the community and in Canada as well.
That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC weather and traffic report.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. We begin with Monday, January 6th. We had a daytime high of -8, but it felt much colder and a mix of sun and cloud, and that is dropping down to -13 overnight. Tuesday, January 7th, a daytime high of -7 with a 40% chance of flurries, dropping down to a bone-chilling -16 overnight. Wednesday, January 8th, going to see a daytime high of -9 with a 30% chance of flurries, dropping a full 10 degrees to closer to -19 overnight. Thursday, January 9th, we are going to see a daytime high of -8 with a 30% chance of flurries, dropping down to -12 overnight. Friday, January 10th, high of -4. It'll be cloudy. We'll see a drop of about 7 degrees to -11 overnight. Saturday, January 11th, daytime high of -5 with a 40% chance of snow, dropping down to -9 overnight. And Sunday, January 12th, we're going to see a daytime high of -3 and it will be cloudy. Monday, January 13th, we'll see a high of -5, dropping down to -10 overnight. And Tuesday, January 14th, a high of -8 with an overnight low of -11. This is Jesse Bell with the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week of Monday, January 6th, 2025. Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl. Expect delays and closures along Aberdeen Street for a contractor to complete road and sewer reconstruction. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles / Edwin to Princess. Expect delays while a contractor completes Phase 2 of the Princess and Collins Bay Active Transportation Improvements. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, cycling, and pedestrian improvements. For project details, please visit Get Involved Kingston. Motorists are advised to seek alternative routes. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard at Elmwood. Expect delays while a contractor upgrades the intersection at Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard and Elmwood Street, including replacement of street lighting, new traffic lights, replacement of asphalt on roadways, and a new multi-use pathway south of the intersection towards Bath Road.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a song from local metal band Exigen's debut EP entitled Game of Puppets, released on all streaming platforms on Friday, January 3rd. Featuring four heavy genre blending tracks, the EP was created by Ben Snyder, Joe Shell, Nathan Graham, and Isaac Heathcock, and produced by Terry Benn at Switzerville Sound Retreat. "We've been fortunate to have amazing fans and friends supporting us," says the band, and they hope to keep the metal scene growing in Kingston. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Game of Puppets on your favorite platforms and enjoy today's selection from this new EP called Fleeting Moments, here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Kingston-based folk trio The Kildares with their first single called The Escape, a song about rekindling hope by escaping the everyday with someone special. Featuring energetic mandolin and warm harmonies, the lyrics connect with anyone wishing to sneak away into the night. It's the first release off The Kildares' upcoming debut album, Faster Than Light, due this spring, 2025. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream The Kildares' single, The Escape, now on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Run away. If we are faster than the light, just disappear into the night. Love, I swear, they'll never know we're gone. just disappear into the night. Love, I swear, they'll never know we're gone.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by the Sugar Pills called Sugar Pill. The latest track gives listeners a window into a night out in Kingston with the band. It speaks to making your own fun regardless of time or place. Sugar Pill has that quintessential feel-good factor, leaving you with an optimistic glow. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Sugar Pill by the Sugar Pills on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Liam's at the bar stealing coasters. They say he's outside admiring our poster. Evan's waiting on a drink he ordered 20 minutes ago. An old guy just offered me a beer, but I know if I take it, I'll have to stay here. And all of this has got me wondering if I should have gone home when Caleb did. And now it's 2 a.m. and so I'll offer them a handful of sugar pills. I'll take one if you will.
This is CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus and community radio station, broadcast from the basement of Kerutas Hall, Queen's University, Kingston. You can also hear this program locally on Cogeco Cable, channel 282, and is streamed online at cfrc.ca.
Welcome to Biotech Beat. This is your host, Krista. Today we will hear a webinar by Dr. Cassandra DeMori on physical activity behavior in middle-aged and older adults. This program is produced and distributed by Canadian Longitudinal Study on Aging. Before that, you have a few messages.
Tree Canada's National Greening Program is planting seedlings across five regions of the country: BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They plant in areas that are in need of reforestation or afforestation across Canada. Tree Canada selects sites where appropriate native species will be planted to make sure that natural forests come back to life. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband Tom and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it. So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
CFRC is active on every social media platform. Check us out at CFRC Radio on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and on Twitter at CFRC.
I'm a postdoctoral fellow here at McMaster University, working under Dr. Marla Beauchamp in the School of Rehabilitation Science. And today I'm going to be talking to you about physical activity behavior in middle age and older adults. So I'm going to start by giving us a little bit of an introduction on physical activity in case not everyone is as familiar with it. And then I'm going to touch on two of my papers that came out of my thesis work. And then finally, I'm going to provide a little bit of a snapshot of one way that we can involve our community members in secondary data analysis and finish up with some limitations, implications, and next steps for myself. So physical activity, before we begin, I want to make sure we are all talking about the same thing. So I'll be using the World Health Organization's definition, which is any bodily movement produced by skeletal muscle that requires energy expenditure. So this is actually a very broad term that relates to more than just exercise. And one of the main ways we talk about and measure physical activity is through the term intensity. So we can see here on the screen a scale of intensity, starting from the far left, which includes sedentary activity, and then three levels of physical activity: light, moderate, and vigorous. And so as we move along our arrow to the right side of the screen, these activities require more energy or more effort for us to complete, with vigorous being the most intense or requiring that most amount of energy, and sedentary activity itself requiring the least amount of energy or being the least intense. Now, one of the other terms in the physical activity literature that's really important and comes up a lot is this term inactivity. And this is actually defined by an individual who does not achieve 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity in a week. And we know based on this definition that one in four adults worldwide are considered inactive and not reaching this amount of physical activity in a week. And we can see that reflected here in Canada. Here we can see that for all our age groups and regardless of sex, we have a percentage higher than 25 for the number of people considered inactive. And there's two other really important trends that we can see here in Canada. And that is that our older age group, so this second bar here where we're looking at 70 years and older, have a greater percentage of people considered inactive, as well as if we look at it by sex. So we can see these pink bars here who represent our females, again, have a higher percentage in both age groups who are considered inactive. And this is unfortunate given the limited amount of evidence we have specifically for females, as well as what we call disaggregated by ages. So when I refer to that, what I'm saying is we want to know, rather than older adults as a group, our smaller age bands, such as 60 to 65, 65 to 70, how do they actually do their physical activity? Now that we know what inactivity is, I have the unfortunate news of telling you that inactivity is a global health crisis. In particular, in high-income Western countries, we have evidence showing that our inactivity levels have actually been increasing. Specifically here, we see that for females and males from 2000 to 2015, we had about a 5% increase in inactivity levels. And this is unfortunate given this greater relative burden in high-income countries. And one of these reasons could be due to the percentage of deaths in Canada due to non-communicable diseases. So inactivity is having a greater burden on high-income countries like Canada, where we have this high non-communicable disease causes. And so the reasons we care about physical activity is because physical activity is associated with numerous positive health benefits. We know that higher levels of physical activity can help prevent chronic diseases such as diabetes and cardiovascular health. It can improve our functional status through muscle strength and balance. We know it helps with social outcomes like loneliness, and we also know it can improve psychological health. So we've seen associations with both depression and anxiety. And for today's talk, we also want to note that physical activity levels have been shown to improve trajectories of healthy aging. So from a recent study that looked at the evidence from 8 different cohort studies, they showed that when we looked across years and we looked at our healthy aging score, that individuals undertaking any level of physical activity had an increased odds at being in the stable high trajectory of healthy aging. Now, on the flip side of that, when we talk about increasing physical activity levels, we hope that we are also decreasing inactivity levels. So the number of people reaching that 150 minutes increases. And we know that this marker of 150 minutes helps decrease the prevalence of non-communicable diseases. So we talked about that high prevalence in Canada here. So this is one way we know we can help decrease that prevalence, which could therefore help us decrease the burden on our healthcare systems. In a recent paper that came out in 2023, they showed that the healthcare cost estimated from current inactivity prevalences in Canada between now and 2030 was over $500 million per year here in Canada, and over $37 billion Canadian worldwide per year between now and 2030. And when we look at overall the healthcare costs associated with inactivity, we can see that the majority of healthcare costs is actually landing in these high-income countries, with 63% of this cost going to them. So with all this information in tow, we created my thesis, which had a couple specific goals or gaps I was hoping to start to address in the literature. So one of the first ones was understanding what people are actually doing. So beyond this 150 minutes cutoff, what are people actually doing in the different behaviors? And importantly, as I mentioned early, I really wanted to address older adults and females. And in the context of Canada, as we saw, we have such a relative burden for inactivity and limited evidence more so in our older adult populations. So these are the areas I was hoping to build in for my thesis. So a comprehensive understanding of what people are doing, looking at female subgroups, as well as doing that age disaggregated analysis. So looking at smaller bands of age. So today I'm going to be talking about 2 papers that want to try and address this work. The first is looking at normative values for the physical activity scale for the elderly. And the second is where I tried to describe the physical activity behavior in middle-aged and older Canadians. So both of these papers were done in the Canadian Longitudinal Study on Aging, which is the reason we're all here today. So I'm not really going to go into depth about the study itself. But as a reminder, at baseline, we had just over 51,000 participants who were 45 to 85 years old. The work I'm presenting today does focus on baseline data. But the one thing I want to highlight of the study today is how we've measured physical activity, at least up until the most current follow-up. So at baseline, or more specifically, the maintaining contact questionnaire and follow-up 1, participants in both cohorts were offered to complete the physical activity scale for the elderly. So that's what we're going to be working with for the next two studies. So the physical activity scale for the elderly, which I'm going to refer to as PACE, is a 7-day retrospective questionnaire. So it asks participants about what they've done in the last 7 days specifically. It was designed to be more reflective of older adults in particular, based on the examples they provided and the types of activities they included. It has been used in over 35 different countries and has numerous translated versions. Now, it consists of 10 questions, which cover 13 items or activity types. An example of some of these questions is on the right-hand screen here. So there's about 5 questions where we get a little bit more detail on what people are doing. And from these 5 questions, we get a frequency as well as a duration, and it's an open-ended question on what types of activities they are actually doing. Now, for the activities that were included, this is one of the aspects that kind of goes into the pro columns of the PACE, because it has such a wide variety of types of activities as well as intensity. So, for example, we have light sport all the way up to strenuous sport and recreation. We have caregiving duties. We have work. We have home care. We also have sitting, which is a sedentary activity. Now, for today, we are focusing on physical activity. And so I'm going to be talking about the total PACE score. So that includes 12 of those 13 items because it doesn't account for sitting as it's a sedentary activity. Now, the total PACE score ranges from 0 to over 400. And we know that higher scores means a person is more active. However, the score itself doesn't have any units. So we don't know based on that score how much time they spent or how much energy was required to do all these activities. We just know that 400 means they're more active than 10. Now, from a recent scoping review that some of our team members did, we were able to look at the breadth and extensiveness in which the PACE has been used, and we found that multiple versions of the PACE have been shown to be valid and have strong test-to-test reliability. If you want more details on that, that is available open access, so I'm not going to go into too much there. But this brings me around to the first paper I wanted to discuss today, and that is the normative values for the physical activity scale for the elderly in men and women 45 to 85 years old. So the objective of this paper was to create age and sex-specific normative values for the PACE for community-dwelling people aged 45 to 85 years old using the CLSA. The normative values provide a reference based on a healthy population that allows for comparison to a standard and can be used to indicate whether something is amiss or in need of intervention. One great example of normative values that a lot of us are familiar with are the height and weight growth curves that we use to monitor children's growth. So that one example is on the right-hand side here, where we have the age of the children on the bottom, and then up the sides, we have either their weight or their height. And doctors and healthcare providers can use this to track their age, their height, or weight, and see where they fall compared to a healthy or normal individuals. And this can help play an important role for monitoring the progress of health characteristics and identifying individuals needing investigation or maybe an intervention. So for this analysis, we had to identify or decide what our healthy or our normal or average population was going to be in the context of physical activity and an aging population. So we defined this as anyone who did not experience physical activity restrictions. And this was done by excluding individuals who had a mobility limitation, specifically used a gait aid, or reported a limitation in any basic or instrumental activities of daily living. Additionally, anyone who had missing data on either of these or had an incomplete physical activity questionnaire, they were excluded from this analysis. Now, we did check the validity of this exclusion criteria, and we saw that for the total sample, as well as by males and females, that the individuals identified as having a physical activity restriction did have a significantly lower physical activity level compared to those included in the sample. So as I mentioned, we did stratify this by sex to kind of hit one of those goals we have for this work. And then in order to create the normative values ourselves, we followed the protocols and methods that were developed and laid out by some of our co-authors, but particularly led by Dr. Alexander Mayhew when she put out this first paper here looking at normative values for physical performance measures in the CLSA. And we were lucky enough to have Dr. Mayhew come on our team and help us run the code and run these analyses. But the model was decided on based on looking at quantile regression-based models, as well as general additive models for location, scale, and shape. And this did use cross-validation, where we had a 70% training and 30% test. Now, for this analysis, we had a total of 36,701 participants included after our restrictions, and they represented just over 9.5 million Canadians 45 to 85 years old without physical activity restriction. Now, the one characteristic I wanted to highlight based on its relevance to this work was the percentage of people who felt that the physical activity they reported over the last 7 days was reflective of their last 12 months. And so that was pretty high at 70%. Now, what we were able to do with this analysis is similar to the growth curves that I showed on that first objective slide there, was create charts as well as tables where we listed the total PACE score for each age and percentile. So I have one example here for our female growth, our female percentile curves, where we have our ages along the bottom and our PACE scores along the vertical axis. And here we can see the different percentiles for each age going from the 95th all the way to the 5th. So one of the first things we noticed when looking at these curves was that regardless of the fact that these individuals weren't experiencing any physical activity restrictions, even amongst the most active, if we look at the 95th percentile, we see that our physical activity was still decreasing with age. We also noted this idea that age might be really important to consider when we're comparing physical activity, and there might be a little bit of an unfair penalization to individuals if we're just treating everything the same regardless of age. So a great example of this would be if we looked at a single score of 172 on the PACE. So that score was achieved by a 45-year-old female. She'd be about the 50th percentile for her age. Now, if we look at an 85-year-old female, she would land around the 95th percentile for her age. So the 85-year-old is doing really well comparative to her age group, whereas the 45 is running more in the middle of the pack. So in summary for this first paper, this was really the first to look at age and sex-specific normative values for the PACE from a population-based study. It helps to increase the interpretability of that total score and then hopefully the utility of the PACE. And then even amongst those without PA restrictions, we did note that there is still a downwards trend in physical activity levels with increasing age, and that females had consistently lower physical activity levels than males, which is similar to the previous literature. And I'm talking about my second paper, which was looking at physical activity behavior in middle-aged and older Canadian women and men. And this was meant to be more of like a descriptive deep dive rather than looking at mean values. So we really wanted to describe a full spectrum of usual physical activity by the type and the amount. So we had two specific objectives that we were looking at. The first was to explore physical activity behavior in Canadians using subgroups of known correlates of physical activity. So we had individual level socioeconomic variables, as well as neighborhood level, and then age and sex and region and season. And then in order to look at the amount, we also looked at quintiles of physical activity scores. So for this sample, anyone who completed the maintaining contact questionnaire was eligible to be included. So we had just under 48,000 participants. Of those, 633 were missing their total PACE score. Now, based on looking at the missing data, we did decide to go with pairwise deletion. So that does mean that for some of these different analyses, there are different sample sizes. Now, to get to the gist of it, which was to try and capture this comprehensive description of PA, we looked at four different physical activity outcomes. The first is that validated total PACE score. Secondly, we looked at the proportion of PACE score from each activity, meaning the percent of their total activity or their total physical activity that was made up by each type. And that goes from zero to they did not do that activity to 100%. That would be the only activity they did. Third, we looked at the prevalence of each activity. So just yes or no, was that done in the last 7 days? And then finally, we did operationalize the 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity, yes, no. So for this analysis, as similar with other CLSA studies, you'll see that we did have a very high percentage of self-identified European background, a high good or better self-reported general health, as well as a high post-secondary degree and diploma. So what I'm going to do to take us through these results is I'm going to highlight some of the key patterns or findings that we noted through all of these analyses. So the first thing we noticed was the presence of these social determinants of health and how they may be influencing physical activity levels. So a great example of this would be household income. So on the left-hand side of our screen, we have our sample divided into quintiles of physical activity level, where quintile 1 is our least active group and quintile 5 is our most active group. And then each of these bars are made up of the percentage of people from each income category. So we focus on our $150,000 a year income. We see that as we increase in activity level, the percentage of people in that group that are from this highest income increases. And we see the opposite trend is true when we look at our households that have less than $20,000 a year. As we become more active, that group has a lower percentage of individuals in this income category. And we saw a very similar trend in our education. So again, least active to most active, and our highest education is the white. So as we increased in activity level, we did see that the degree and diploma percentage increased in each quintile. Now, we found very similar patterns when we looked at the percentage of individuals who reported good health. However, when we looked at the percentage of females in each quintile, we saw that as physical activity level increased, the percentage of females in each quintile decreased. Now, we took a little bit of a deeper dive into some of those socioeconomic patterns. And we noted that the greatest difference in physical activity was found between the lowest socioeconomic group and the next level up. So if we look at household income, what we're seeing is that the difference between each group that are now grouped by income, so this is our whole sample, and this is the proportion that were in our highest income category, and their mean PACE score was 173. The jump down to 171, 156, 133, and then to our lowest income group, which was less than 20,000, we jumped to 105. So we saw that biggest gap in PACE scores between the lowest and the second level. And similarly, we saw this jump in the lowest in education to the second rung. Now, this could suggest that there may be a threshold of some form at which these variables have a greater impact on physical activity level, or maybe below that level, the barriers to physical activity are greater. And it might suggest more targeted interventions could be useful in these groups. Now, when we did look at age and sex patterns in physical activity, similar to previous literature, we saw that PACE scores decreased with increasing age, and regardless of the age group, females had lower physical activity. But one of the things we wanted to do in this analysis was to try and understand type of physical activity and how that played into different patterns. So here we can see on the left-hand side these gray squares. The first chunk is for our female participants, and the second chunk is for our males. Each column represents an age group, so we go 45 to 54, all the way up to 75 plus. Now, the squares represent the proportion of total PACE score for males and females across each age group. And when we're looking at them, the darker squares indicate that a greater proportion of a group's total score was contributed by that activity. So I'm going to jump right to an example to just help us orient here. So for example, if we look at work, we see that for both males and females, the darkest square is found in our youngest age group, meaning that work contributed a larger percentage of their total activity compared to their older ages. And we can see there was a bit of a flip when we looked at light indoor activity, where as we got older, light indoor activity became more important to their overall activity level. We did also notice some trends between males and females. So for example, we saw that both indoor light and heavy household work appeared to be slightly more important for overall levels of physical activity in women than men, and same with caregiving. And we saw a bit of a flip when we looked at heavy outdoor activity, where heavy outdoor activity contributed a greater percentage of their overall activity for males, suggesting that there might be some differences in some areas where we could perform more targeted interventions between these groups. Now, the last pattern I'm really going to highlight in today is looking at regional patterns of physical activity. As we know, Canada is a very broad country with a lot of different geographical attributes across it. So we broke our sample into the BC, the prairies, Central and Atlantic Canada, in order to see if there was any patterns of physical activity. And what we noted was that when we looked at the whole year, so all of the sample, individuals in the prairies had the highest level of PEA on average. Now, what we also did in order to account for seasonality, as most of us know here in Canada, that depending on the time of year, the weather can be very different. And we have seen evidence suggesting that the time of year or the climate can impact physical activity levels. So then we took these groups and looked at their activity in each season, more or less. And what we saw was that there was a lot more variability in physical activity levels when we looked at it by season. So on the right-hand side here, we have each season that we created, as well as the region of Canada. And then along the Y here is our total pace scores. What we found was that even looking at the seasons, Atlantic Canada still had the lowest physical activity levels three quarters of the year. Now, one interesting thing we did note was that for Central and Atlantic Canada, their highest levels of physical activity were actually from July to September, whereas the prairies and the BC had their highest levels of physical activity in October through December, which again suggests this variability across Canadians that may call for more than just one national campaign and maybe some more specific targeted physical activity promotion in the future. So in summary, this analysis provided a comprehensive description of PA behavior in middle age and older Canadians. We saw physical activity patterns for social determinants of health. So we noted that threshold in our lowest category groups for those socioeconomic patterns. We saw that there was different types of activity preferences potentially between different age and sex groups. And we also noted that Canada, when we speak about it regionally, may have some diversity in when and how we're being active across Canada. So I'm going to take a little bit of a turn here. So now that you've seen the two papers that I worked on and understand a little bit of what was done and how it was done, I'm going to discuss how I actually included a little bit of community engagement in this work. So before I get into the small snapshot of what it looks like to involve community engagement in a trainee project, I just wanted to briefly highlight that community engagement, also sometimes known as participatory research, co-design, there's a variety of terms, but it is really broad and can cover a whole variety of methods as well as when we're involving. So I've taken this table actually from a research brief that was published by the McMaster Collaborative for Health and Aging, just to give us a quick overview of the different research phases and different types of activities that people have already used community engagement in. Now, keeping in mind, my example was in a PhD project. So there was a couple restrictions when it comes to involving this into my work. So we did obviously have a timeline crunch because my degree had a certain end date, as well as financial, you only have so much money when it comes to PhD work. So what we managed to do was create a public advisory committee. And they were involved specifically in these two stages. So reviewing results, making sense of findings, as well as helping us come up with ideas on how we may translate this knowledge to the community. So in order to create this public advisory committee, this was done mostly through word of mouth, through groups at McMaster University. We said we were looking for individuals 45 years and older, just based on our sample age. We were hoping individuals would attend 2 to 3 virtual meetings. That would be 90 minutes over the next year. And then individuals reached out to us. The other way we did look at recruitment was through the Voice platform, which is hosted by McMaster's Institute for Research on Aging. And this is a pretty cool platform that helps researchers conduct meaningful community public engagement. It allows you to post opportunities onto the website, and then individuals who are part of that community, who could be older adults, caregivers, members of the public, have the option to look at your opportunity and potentially reach out. I don't know all the details because I only used it for this one snippet, but I provided the link in case you're interested in looking at something like that to help you with something similar to what I've done. So what the timeline actually looked like.
That's it, folks. Tune in for another round of Biotech Beat, same time next week.
Keep up with what's hot on CFRC Airwaves. Find us today on Instagram and Facebook. Follow us